in the East and in the West. It is always a pleasure to listen to Professor Akun for many reasons, but I will single out two. One, because he is a truly original thinker who is renowned for his academic views, which he expounds in his own inimitable way. And secondly, because his lectures draw upon, they're refreshing because they draw upon not only on Islamic scholarship, both Eastern and Western, but also on other disciplines in the social sciences, particularly on anthropology. Professor Akun is currently one of the governors of the Institute of Ismaili Studies. He lectures at the Institute's graduate program. He has worked with the Akan Development Network, and he has delivered lectures to Jamaats in Canada and the United States. And because of our proximity to the Institute, which is about 2 miles from here, we thought perhaps we are nearer than Canada and the States, so we thought we'd have the benefit of the lecture as well, and we are so grateful that Professor Akun has accepted our invitation. We are now inviting him to talk to us on expressions of Muslim identity in the West, Professor Muhammad Akun.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, it's always a pleasure to talk to Ismaili community. As you heard it, I did it several times in many places, and it has been always rewarding for me because you are very much motivated to hear about issues which concern you, concern all Muslims today, issues on which, unfortunately, we remain very ignorant. And it is time to give more importance than we did so far to know what our belonging to Islam, to Islamic culture, what does this mean? And I'm happy that you found yourself this subject. It's not my subject. It has been proposed to me to speak on the expressions, plural. There are many expressions, many different expressions of Muslim identity in the West. As you know, an enormous, infinite debate is going on between what we call generally Islam and the West. Two big words covering so many problems, so many difficult issues, which we ignore on our side, Islamic side, and which the West also is ignorant. I may say from the beginning that we are struggling on the basis of a mutual ignorance, and we are exchanging, if I may say, institutionalized ignorances. I say institutionalized ignorances because the way we teach in Islamic world, the way we teach Islam, the way we teach Islamic culture, the way we teach all what concerns beliefs, Islamic thought, either is insufficient or is not up to date scientifically and intellectually. And also, unfortunately, in many places, especially since Muslim societies recovered their political independence, we teach a wrong Islam. see, I start from this, from the beginning, to give you a picture. And as you see, I start from Muslims, from speaking about Islam and Muslims. You will see why. To introduce us to the problem of identity, I would like to start with some examples. 2 days ago, you may have read, like me, in the newspapers, English newspapers, that a Muslim woman entered a bus, and the driver, she was veiled, the driver asked her to see her face because she had a card to enter, to travel, for her travel. She refused. And the driver asked her to get out of the bus. He refused that she to take her in the bus because he couldn't control whether the card she was holding is her card or not. It's a problem of identity. This is a case. And this case is not exceptional. It is repeated all over Europe. Because as you know, all over Europe we have now significant minorities of Muslims living in all European countries, as well as in North America. So this is not something exceptional. It happens all the time, and you see how difficult it is to handle this issue. I mentioned yesterday with my students who are sitting here with us this case, and their answers, all of them, was only to defend the women who refused to show her face. Because they say the driver should respect the belief of these Muslim women. Something has to be made to solve this problem, that it is not repeated. So it's only up to, or it's dependent on, the country where these Muslims are living to solve the problems. I don't know if you would approach this issue like this, or you would add to this. I agree, of course, that the country has to do something to solve these issues and to facilitate this kind of contacts in the society. But my position is to start from self-criticism and to raise issues about, for example, the meaning of veiling women in Islam. What's the history of this practice? Does this practice go back to the Quran? If it is so, how to read the Quran, how to interpret it today according to the new circumstances in which we are engaged all over the world? And these are problems of identity. It is not relevant to speak always, like we did since the Second World, the end of the Second World War, what I call the discourse of victimization. We are victims. We present ourselves always as victims of imperialism, victims of colonialism, victims of the ignorance of the West, who doesn't recognize us with our identity, etc., etc. This discourse has been used through the last 50s, the last 60s, during the fighting for political independence. Because as you know, all Muslim societies became independent after the Second World War through a political struggle, and this political struggle has been supported with an ideological construct which is based on what we can call the discourse of victimization. This is one example. We shall analyze it further. The second example, which is related very deeply to the problem of identity, Muslim identity. Last week in Paris, in the Institute of the Arab World. You know maybe this institute in Paris. It has been built now 15 years ago. And it is a very important institution where many cultural activities take place about Arabic culture, Islamic culture, to teach to people who come to the public lectures to hear about issues concerning Arabic culture, Turkish culture, Islamic culture in general. It shows an effort in France to give a space of intellectual and scientific expression for Muslims and French citizens, of course, who can hear about this, that they can be informed about Islamic identity. So last week we had to discuss a book which has been published by one of my colleagues at the Sorbonne. This book deals with the Quran under the title The Lord of Tribes. The Lord of Tribes, meaning by that the Prophet Muhammad, who started to be a preacher, to be a teacher in Mecca, teacher of tribes. The purpose of the book is to read the Quran, especially the first part of the Quran, chronologically speaking, which are the surah delivered in Mecca, revealed in Mecca. There are the surah delivered in Mecca and surah delivered in Medina. It takes 10 years, almost 10 years in Mecca, and 10 years, other years, last years in Medina. So only this part of the Quran has been taken as a subject, but this professor is a historian. He is not a theologian. So the problem here is the possibility for Muslims to read the text of the Quran as historians, to respect the rules of history, the methodology of history. This professor doesn't say that it's wrong or not, that it is revealed or not revealed. She doesn't touch to any issue concerning religious belief, concerning theology. She looks to the social structure in the time the Quran has been revealed, in the political institutions prevailing in Arabia, especially in the Hijaz, in Mecca, and she tries to explain historically, referring to the political context, to the cultural context, through the study, the careful study of the language, to explain. And we need this explanation. We need to give a historical background of the time to understand the Quran. You know what has happened? We were four people invited to discuss this book. Three were French historians also, and there was among us, me, and a Moroccan. A Moroccan who is a learned man, who is a alim. And he started his discourse by saying that this book cannot be used by Muslims because it is not dealing with religious beliefs, and we cannot rely on it as a scholarly book. I don't know, what do you think yourself about this attitude? Which kind of conclusions you will take yourself? And I hope you will tell it to me after I finish my talk, because we have I mentioned these examples to discuss on it, because it touches the problems of identity. There are many examples which I can mention touching this problem of identity. But first, let's tell something about the concept itself of Muslim identity. What do we understand by this concept? Do we mean that there is a particular culture, a particular scale of values, a particular way of life, which is absolutely specific to Muslims and which we cannot find in other cultures, in other religions, with Chinese culture, with Hindu religion, with Jewish religion, etc. Do we mean this? I ask the question to all of you. If we mean this, then we have to answer to many questions. I gave a very general definition by referring to values, by referring to beliefs, by referring to ways of life. What do we do about the cultures, about the institutions, about the languages which are used and spoken by all Muslims all over the world? I mean that if we take only Ismaili community, you belong to cultures which existed before Islam. You speak many languages which are not the Arabic language through which we can have access to Islamic beliefs, we can have access to Islamic values, so we can have access to what we would call then Muslim identity. We reach this Muslim identity through languages which are talking to us about other cultures, totally different from the culture involved in what we call Islam. So you see here how we forget any reference to these cultures, which are still alive today, represented by so many people. If we take only Indonesia, you have hundreds of languages spoken by so many ethno-cultural groups, which are cultures and languages not related to Islam. But they live as Muslims because they make prayers like Muslims, they fast like Muslims, they refer to an Islam which is a very simplified Islam, a very summarized knowledge about Islam. Islam, for many Muslims all over the world, is reduced to some ritual expressions, not to any deep knowledge about what Islamic law, for example, says. Myself, I belong to a population in Algeria where, like in Africa, we speak an oral language, which is Berber language. We have beliefs still practiced and alive among people which go back far before Islam. And we never have applied in this part of Algeria what we call Islamic law. And this is true for so many groups of people all over the world. So if we want really to speak about identity, we must be fair about these cultures which we ignore by holding a definition of identity which is, as I said in the beginning, very abstract one, very general one. It's a number of images and ritual practices, but it doesn't cover the real references which are used by people and to which people stick since centuries. In spite of the expansion of Islam, in spite of the faith that people affirm that they have an Islamic faith. So there is a difference if we want to go the scientific way to approach the problem of identity. We must start from the statement that Islamic tradition, as we learn it through the books written mainly in medieval ages, from 7th century to 13th century, it is the time when Islamic theology has been elaborated, when Islamic law has been elaborated and enforced by the caliph, either the Abbasid caliph, the Umayyad caliph, or the Fatimid caliph, Ismaili Fatimid caliph. This time also we had, as I mentioned for today, many people belonging to different cultures and who lived under Islamic law, and in the same time remained, for example, attached to Aramean culture, to Syriac culture, many cultures in the Middle East, or in Indonesia, or in China, or everywhere where Muslims have expanded their presence and their religion. What I want to say here, another point about Muslim identity, of which we are not aware when we claim, especially facing the West, to defend our identity, our presence in Western societies. I want to stress the point that the definition of Islamic theology, of Islamic thought, Islamic law, the definition of Quranic exegesis on which Muslim identity is based, all this knowledge, all these sciences flourished in the medieval, what we call the medieval ages. After 13th century, we have no significant theological activity. We have no significant philosophical activity. We have no activity in Quranic exegesis which would say something different from what has been said in 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th century. We just reproduce what the classical authors, Sunni and Shia, have written in this period, which we call the classical period of Islam. In other terms, what I am saying now, that the identity, Muslim identity, to which we refer, is obliged either to go back to these authors, to learn about what theology is about, to learn what the elaboration of Islamic law is about. So we have to study these authors, to reactivate the thinking of these authors to support this Muslim identity to which we want to stick and which we want to defend today, facing the challenge of Western culture and Western thought. This is one possibility, and I shall come back to this possibility. The second possibility is to express our identity in Muslim societies as well in European societies on the basis of ignorance of that classical Islam. And actually, today, we ignore it. And we are speaking out of ignorance of that period of what has been built concerning Muslim identity in that period. I say that we have to refer to the authors in medieval ages. Is this sufficient for us to claim our belonging to a Muslim identity facing Europeans, Westerners today? Is it the right way to go? Is it sufficient that in the Institute of Ismaili Studies we teach the exegesis of the Quran by Tabari or by Tosi or by Fakhreddin Razi or others? Is it relevant to refer to the theology of Shaykh al-Mufid, to Qadi Nu'man, to other authors in that period, and to tell to Europeans We are Muslims. Here is our identity. This is not a relevant attitude. It cannot be a solution. It is a part of the solution. I am not telling that we should not study this, that we should not go back to this. But we should go back to this only to learn historically how Islamic identity has grown up through history, how it has been shaped through history in several contexts, cultural contexts. This we have to understand. But we have to do other things. And the reason why the problem of identity became today the problem of every society. Western societies also are developing a crisis of identity. Not for the same reasons as we do, but they have also a crisis of identity. They cannot speak about themselves with the same certitude about the values of their culture, about the values of their civilization, as they did until the Second World War. The certitude which European thinking had in 19th century, when Europe colonized the rest of the world, telling that our civilization is a civilization for all the world, for all people in the world, and they considered this civilization as superior to the others, then they didn't have a crisis of identity. They had euphoria, self-confidence to do what they did. Today, they don't have any more this. Especially when they see, for example, migrants coming in European societies. You see how they speak about Islam, they fear the violence of Islam. They fear to lose their identity if more and more Muslims come in the society and make the reverse of what has happened in 19th century. They fear this. So we have to ask ourselves, what happened to all societies to have such a deep concern about their own identity, their own personality, their own past as a past for references to maintain the validity of their values, of their beliefs, of their institutions? What has happened to all these people? We have to face the problem of modernity, because modernity is responsible of the disintegration, fragmentation, disqualification of all values, whether it is philosophical, whether it is secularized, whether it is advanced through technology like in the West, or whether it is traditional, conservative, like we have still in our Islamic societies, Islamic life. Modernity is an enormous historical event, because this event concerns the activity of human mind itself. It affects the function of human mind itself. In short words, because I cannot enter in the details, in short words, what is the difference between the attitude of human mind in what we call modernity and the attitude of human mind in all cultures, in all societies, before modernity emerged as a new attitude of human mind? This is the question. What makes the difference? First, where did this modernity, which changed the activity, the tools, the references of human mind itself to build a new knowledge, where did it emerge for the first time in history? Did it emerge in the history of Islam in medieval ages? Certainly not. I can demonstrate this, but it would take time. That's why I told you we cannot refer to classical Islam as a tradition of thinking to challenge the present modernity. We shall lose all the time. And we shall be not adapted to the time, not adapted to the problems of the time. I shall tell why. It emerged in Europe. It didn't emerge in China, which is a great civilization, a great culture. It didn't emerge in India, Indian culture, Hindu tradition. It didn't emerge in Africa. It emerged in Europe. And it started to emerge in Europe in 16th century. And I start with one example because it concerns us as Muslims. It concerns our subject on which we are speaking as Muslims. You heard at least the name of Luther. Luther, the German reformer who introduced in the Catholic Church a kind of revolution. What Luther did in 16th century, he claimed the right for free debate and free examination of the Holy Scripture. The Bible and the Gospels are the Holy Scripture for Christians and Jews, like for we Muslims, the Quran. They have the same respect. And Luther said, every believer, Christian believer, should have the right to read the Bible, to read the Gospels, to give his own interpretation, and to debate this interpretation with other believers on an equal level. What I told you, my story about the Quran in the Institute of Arab World, until today is forbidden for us to debate about the Quran, to debate about the interpretation of the Quran. Although theologically, Muslim theology, it gives, recognizes this right for every Muslim. It's a little bit different between Sunni Islam and Shia Islam. Because in Shia Islam, the Imam has a status above all other believers. And in Sunni Islam, there is not, as you know, this conception of the Imam. They believe, they have only the reference to the Caliphate. The status of the Caliphate is different from the status of the Imam. So there is a difference there. But the Imam doesn't forbid to Muslims to take part in the debate about the interpretation. He is a source for interpretation. He can help and give guidance for interpretation, but he doesn't forbid to exercise his mind about interpretation. So you see, we got the possibility. We got in Islam the theoretical possibility to have this free examination as Luther claimed it only in 16th century inside the church. But we didn't, in fact, use this theoretical possibility. We gave up for historical reasons, which I cannot explain, because, again, it will take too much time, and that's why I'm saying that we are ignorant. We should know that. Everyone of you here should know that, and should discuss in the family this issue, this situation, with the children. who are living in London, who are living in France, to give them an intellectual possibility to handle the practical issues in which we are engaged when our children go to the university, go to the school, go outside and discuss all this, and they do not have this information. What happened to us? Nobody can tell. Ignorance. And we complain only that we have problems of identity and that the Westerners are not recognized. You see why I told you. Self-criticism. This what I'm doing now, it's self-criticism. Not self-entitlement to Muslim identity. I cannot support the language of self-entitlement to belong to Muslim identity if I do that on the basis of ignorance. Self-criticism as a constructive activity, as something positive, has to be the first obligation to do. And especially when we face the Westerners, we do not have this language. And I can assure you, when Westerners find somebody who speaks like this, immediately they change their position. They change their evaluation of Islam. They say, yes, this is our problem too. We went through this problem. You are right in resisting to the present modernity, material modernity. But you have no right to resist to intellectual modernity. I'm speaking now on intellectual modernity. So, this is the first step, because with this, the issue of human rights, the issue of the emancipation of the individual, the human person as an individual belonging to a space of citizenship, having the right to speak with other individuals protected by the rule of law. If I say something, I debate about something, nobody will come to kill me, nobody will come to put me in prison. This is the meaning of free examination of Holy Scripture, of free thinking and free debating. This is a conquest by political struggle of Europeans in their societies. It has not given to them without any effort. They went through revolutions here in England, in France, and bloody revolutions, like we have in Algeria. In Algeria, we have the same situation. 200 years later, after French Revolution, Algerians are killing themselves. For what? For having a secularized political regime or having a religious political regime. Like in France, the church as a political power against the state, supported by the new bourgeoisie in Europe, which was a secularized social economic force, and there has been a political struggle where many French have been killed. For this issue, so you see what is at stake. What is at stake about identity? Identity is a very, very deep, important issue related to the philosophical issue, the philosophical problem of the good. The good. The question in philosophy, let's talk a little bit philosophy, not too much. We cannot handle the problem of identity without a minimum of philosophy, without knowing what philosophy is about. Here is another aspect of, I speak particularly to you, Ismaili community, and the problems of identity inside Ismaili community. because Ismailis have many levels to go through to reach a true definition of identity. Why? Because you have first to overcome centuries of exclusion. Ismailis, like other fragments of Islamic Ummah, have been treated since the fall of Alamut by Sunnis as a sect. They do not recognize them as Orthodox Muslims. Here is a problem of identity. How do you feel with Sunnis who tell you you are not Muslims? You don't belong to Muslim identity. Because they hold the principle that they are the true representative of Muslim identity. But who gave them this right to represent the true Muslim identity? Who gave them this right? God? The Quran? No. It is the struggle, the political struggle through history, which shaped what we call Orthodox Islam against heterodox Islam. We come to history, not to religious principles. So you see, you have to face this issue, which is a historical issue, with other Muslims. And then once you have done this work, you have to do the second work on which we are speaking, the work to come to modern expression of Muslim identity. Modern expression of Muslim identity. I come back to my definition. The issue of modernity, you can write this sentence, that you can meditate it, that you can reflect on it. What does it mean? The problem of identity for all societies, for all traditions of thinking, for all religious traditions, without exception, it's not only for Muslims. The problem of identity is connected to the problem of the good. What is good for human being to be done? You understand this? What is good? What is profitable? What is recognized by human being? Whatever is their religion, whatever is their philosophy, what all human beings are claiming to live as human beings, what is good for all human beings? This question, as I put it, is different from the question, what is good for my community only? I ignore the rest of human beings. I work only for my community. Before, when societies were divided into tribes, each tribe would say, what is good for me as a tribe? At the expense of the other tribes. That's why in this kind of regime, and you find it in the Quran, tribes were always fighting against each other because they were looking for their own interest, for their own good. The good I am speaking on is the good as it is seen by modern philosophy. It has been seen also by philosophers in Islam. Farabi, for example, he's a great philosopher in Islam who has written many books, among which we have a book in Arabic, Ara Ahlul Madin al-Fadila, which means the opinions, the thinking of the people of the virtuous city. The virtuous city. Authors too. They may teach us something which we forgot. So we have a choice. Either to have a conception of identity which is open to what His Highness himself speaks always about, humanism, an Islamic humanism, And Islamic humanism is the search for good. Of course, for Muslims, because they are human beings too. But through the good done by Muslims, I reach other people. Like other people will reach me with the good they will do through their communities. If we put the problem of identity in this perspective, then we have to revise our strategy about defending our identity. Our identity will be based on this large perspective, defending the good to be done, from starting from our community, starting from our place where we live, and opening the possibilities of more than a dialogue with other communities, which is our problem with the West. Because suppose that we adopt this definition of identity in England, in France, in America, and we speak then on that common basis, on that common definition with Westerners, then we shall come to the level of discussing the problems of modernity, which is imposing its disintegrating forces, as I said, on all cultures, including Western cultures itself. Then we shall share the same endeavor to look, for example, what's the new possible relationship between our conception as Muslims about our identity as Muslims and the conception of identity as it is presented, defended by Western thinkers since not so long time. The modernity on which I am speaking is emerging since the Second World War only. It didn't exist before. It is new also for Westerners. The problem of modernity today is that modernity cannot deliver an ethical discourse, a moral discourse. This is also another aspect on which His Highness insists always. Ethics. Ethics. What is ethics? Morality. Ethics is a discipline, a philosophical discipline, which speaks about the good to do in our life, in our city, in our family, in our society, and through our family, our society, to reach human being, to reach the level of human being. Otherwise, there is no humanism. If we do not recognize the other as a human being who is seeking for good also, the other will never recognize us as a human being. There is a reciprocity. And here also there is this concept of the other. If we develop a closed concept of identity, if we look only for our identity as Ismailis, as Ithna Ashari, as Sunni, as Protestant, as etc., etc., the war will continue. Then there is no possibility for a shared values and shared humanism. We cannot evolve. And here you see the difference also. Religions. Until the modernity emerged, what was the basic teaching of religions? The basic. Related to identity. Religions would say the community of the believers are the only persons who deserve my recognition, who deserve my solidarity. The non-believers, the kuffar, the infidels, the polytheists, they are out of my horizon for doing good. Either they come to me, they enter in the community, they embrace my religion, then they become like others. They are raised to the level of humanity, to the level of solidarity. If they do not convert, they will remain outside. Christianity did this. Out of the church, there is no salvation, says the church. But we too say it. Out of Islam, there is no salvation. We say it too. And we lived on this concept of identity for centuries. We are still living on this concept of identity, which is very dangerous. We are reading every day news coming from Muslim countries. What's your feeling when you read in the newspaper that Muslims, in the name of God, have killed tourists coming to visit a place to have culture by love for this culture, by love for what human being has invented, created centuries and centuries ago, and I go to that place, a place of culture, a place resurrected by Western ulama, Western historical research. The pharaonic civilization and culture was ignored for centuries in Egypt. It is only in the beginning of the 19th century that it is rediscovered. Identity. How identity is expressed. How identity is lived. If we do not break this rigid, dogmatic, intolerant definition of identity, Muslim identity or Protestant identity or whatever, because all others, they do the same. We are not the only one. I'm defining identity on the level of the compared history of cultures and religions. But we, unfortunately, something happened to us as Muslims. Since 13th century, we didn't move ahead intellectually. No intellectual move. No intellectual change. So that even the intellectual conquest which we had in the centuries before, as I said, even this has been forgotten. We cannot refer to it. We do not refer so much to Farabi, whom I mentioned. We do not refer to the philosopher Averroes, to the other thinkers, theologians. We do not refer. If we could refer to them, nobody would go to kill tourists or to kill priests, as it happened in Algeria. You remember? Priests. Killing priests. We came to Algeria to do good. They did good. They have been chosen as victims in the name of identity. So identity is a very, very dangerous word. We have to be careful in handling it. And if we want to reach a humanist open concept of identity, I am not saying that we have to copy modernity and to use modernity as we get it from the West. No, I told you just now, we come to the level of discussing modernity after the long route of self-criticism to know what happened to us so that we can do what Westerners have done since 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century, 4 centuries of work, 4 centuries of creativity. Look, for example, the book of John Locke on tolerance. You read English. Read the book of John Locke. Read the books, the book of Hobbes on the Leviathan. You will see the struggle of people here to come out from a dogmatic, closed definition of identity, which was proclaimed and maintained and taught officially by the church. The church, like our mosque, if I may speak like this, mosque as an institution, the church as an institution of power, is teaching, as I told you, a wrong Islam, a wrong concept of Muslim identity. And this wrong teaching is affecting us and creating all the difficulties, like the one on the veil, like the one on the Rushdie affair. You know Rushdie affair here. How Muslims reacted? I would like to know how Ismailis reacted, by the way, during the Rushdie affair. What was your reaction? On which side were you standing for this affair? And with which intellectual tools did you handle this big, violent, passionate struggle between Europeans and Muslims? Here are examples of expressions of identity, of Muslim identity. We are in a big intellectual, spiritual, moral crisis. We got political independence, but we are very far from intellectual independence. And by the way, I should say, there is no intellectual independence. There is always a solidarity between human beings for intellectual endeavor to change our relationship and to change our conceptions. I would like to end this by giving some thoughts about the Ismaili community itself. I do not consider that Ismailis are not affected by the general problems which I mentioned. They are affected like all our contemporaries, all people in the world. So they have to share that level. Now, what makes Ismailis as Muslims in a better position to do something in the line I am trying to explain, in a better position than other Muslims? This I told everywhere. And it seems that this idea is not really integrated in Ismaili thinking, inside the community, I mean. Ismailis do not have one political territory with political frontiers where they would live and develop an identity linked to one country. Ismailis experienced through their history the same historical adventure as Jews after the destruction of the temple in 70 after Jesus Christ. Yes, they lost their country, and they have been spread all over the world around the Mediterranean area. This emigration of Jews is named diaspora, diaspora of Jews. They didn't have a state, and they couldn't have a synagogue which is the equivalent of the mosque or the church. They couldn't develop one synagogue as the center of power, political power, and the the reference for all Jews for spiritual authority. They couldn't, because they were living as minorities. In Muslim societies as well as in Christian societies. And this history is very interesting to study. You should study this because it gives insights and it enlightens the experience, the historical experience of Ismailis, who have been obliged also to be spread all over the world, especially after the Second World War, because many Ismailis who were in Africa, who were in Bangladesh, who were in India, have been obliged, for reasons you know, to move to Europe. They have been living in African cultural environment, Asian cultural environment, and suddenly they had to move to Europe. That's why the problem of identity became more present. But my point is this. The fact that you do not need to relate to one country to defend one identity there obliges you to consider the problem of identity in a pluralist approach, not in monolithic approach. Because you have to respect the culture of Ismailis in Tajikistan, of Ismailis in Uzbekistan, of Ismailis in Syria, which is the start of Ismaili movement, Ismailis in India, and now Ismailis in European countries. This is an advantage. It is a privilege, because it puts you on the track I described, to think about identity in an open manner, not in a closed manner. And the other privilege is that you do not need to develop, to have political parties to struggle inside one territory for coming to power, like all Muslims do in their society with their government. This is a privilege. It gives you the space free to think about problems of spirituality, problems of ethic, problems of intellectual life, because you do not need to participate to these political struggles where problems of identity, problems of culture are handled with ideological, political aims, not with intellectual, cultural concerns. That's why we see the difference, for example, what is happening in all Muslim countries. You see that in all Muslim countries, Islam is a political weapon. It is not anymore a spiritual experience. It is not an ethical concern for developing an ethical thinking on the level of modern search for a new ethics. And the third privilege, of course, is that although you are spread all over the world, you have a guidance, a guide, an imam. And this imam is not a political man. He is concerned with spiritual life. He is concerned with philosophical values. He is concerned with intellectual activity. Because without this activity, you will remain in the closed definition of identity, which I mentioned. You will not move out this closed definition of identity. And this is the meaning of the institute in which we are working. And I heard from some of you that Ismailis living in London are the most people who are not well informed, I should say, about what we are doing there. This is not normal, because this institute is aware of all what I'm saying about problems of identity. Problems of identity, as you see, include problems of civilization. And we are going towards a new civilization, which is not the civilization of yesterday, neither in the West, nor in Islam, nor in China, nor anywhere in the world. We are going towards a new civilizational creativity. And if we are unable to understand what this movement means, which are the tools required to participate to this movement, if we do not have appropriate institutions of learning like this institute, and the one is not sufficient. Of course it is not sufficient. We are very modest. We have 10, 12 students each year coming, and these students are more or less prepared. They are here, they hear me. They know that. More or less prepared to this kind of exercise. But they do their best once they are with us in the institute. Normally they should come already prepared in their secondary schools to know what social sciences are about. Because we use these social sciences to study all the problems I mentioned about Islam, the history of Islam, the history of Islamic thought. All this is needed, that these people go back to their families, to the country where they live, and they spread these ideas. And for the moment, you know, I think I am not exaggerating in saying that Ismailis are doing well in computer sciences, in business management, in some hard sciences, as we call it. But for the human sciences, which are essential to face the challenges about identity, for this we are still weak, very weak. In spite of the resources that you have to create more possibilities, more institutes for this kind of learning, and to enter really in another level of exchange with Westerners and of course all other cultures and all other people in the world. And then Islam will be open to another historical space, to another historical move, like it happened in this remote time in medieval ages. But unfortunately this has been interrupted by the history through which we went since 13th century, as I said. Now I'm going to listen to your not only questions, but if you have any criticism about what I say. I like criticism. Ah, yes. We make progress through criticism. But criticism done with rules. Rules of exchange to go further in our discussions. Thank you for your attention.
as an individual and then as an Ismaili, I took the middle position, and I work in a secular setting where I deal with Islam in schools, to also reassure you that my first degree is in theology, you know.
Very good, we need that.
Not subscribe to the fatwa of Salman Rushdie, I felt that there comes a point in time when your intellectual freedom becomes a license. And therefore, I did not think that that was intellectual freedom, that I thought that at that point, this particular writer misused this freedom that is a privilege as a Muslim thinker. And perhaps did not maintain a balance. So that was my view. But I wanted to talk a little further about your discussion on identity, if I may, Chairman Sahib. It was quite interesting, and although you didn't use the word exclusive identity, that's the way I understand it, and if I misrepresent you, by all means correct me. And I agree with you that we cannot afford to be exclusive, we cannot afford to be isolated. But as an Ismaili in a Western context, we do need criteria by which we function. And I absolutely am on your ground that ultimately we go for a humanitarian identity. However, I'd be very interested in what is your thinking on how we do provide, not just for ourselves as individuals, but also for our youths, some kind of criteria by which we then do not tilt the balance, as it were. And I'm interested in your response.
Yes.
Thank you.
So I would like to know more about the position of Madame on the Rushdie affair, as she had expressed it. She has expressed it. I don't know if you share what she says, or if you have other things to say about this, because this is a test, an important test, about the way we are handling the problem of identity as Muslims living in the West. Saying, like you said, that he misused the freedom given to the writer, we can accept this position if we add that Muslim societies and the cultures as it is lived in Muslim societies today do not allow to understand the importance, the great importance of this piece of literature, Satanic Verses. This we can say, yes, we have to respect the situation as it is, but it cannot be an intellectual answer, because the intellectual answer to this issue is that we must work in our societies, in our conservative culture, that we reach the point where we understand that a book like this is not only useful, but it is needed, it is necessary to come out from our dogmatic conception of values, of Islamic references, etc. In the West, they came out of the dogmatic teaching of the Church through books like this, written by Voltaire, written by Montesquieu, written by Montaigne, written by Shakespeare, written by etc. many people, participated to the battle. It is a battle of human mind against human mind. We have to understand this. Otherwise our mind will remain always conservative. We shall always close doors to progress, to intellectual progress. And we cannot all the time refer to the necessary respect that we have to pay to traditional cultures. Because we pay this respect, because we obey to this criteria, look where we are. Now, criteria for the teenagers, criteria for the young people, but criteria for the adults also. Because I see this as something which has to be discussed in all families. When your daughter or your son come from the school and raise a question of identity, a case which he has witnessed at school, at university or somewhere, and he asks you, father, mother, uncle, etc., some advice about this. How do you handle this? Which answers you give to your child who needs your advice? If you do not have any criteria to know what religious belief is about, how to present religious belief to a teenager today. When you defend something as a Muslim, you are referring to Islamic values, but are you asking yourself, from where these Islamic values I am teaching to my child come? How can I participate to these values if I do not want know who elaborated it? Where is their origin? What does it mean and what does it bring to me as Muslim, and for human being, as I said? If you don't add this question, human being, you are cutting yourself from the human condition. And when you cut yourself from human condition, don't be astonished that you are treated as someone who wants to remain apart. Again, we have to read philosophers about this. We have no philosophical culture at all. It disappeared from our intellectual tradition. Even the students, when I speak about philosophy, I have to be extremely careful, because I see on their faces that they are not following what I'm saying. Yes, but it is necessary. There is no modernity without philosophy. There is no democracy without philosophy. And this is demonstrated through history. It's not just a statement that I'm making to defend philosophy. No. Why? Because philosophy is concerned with human mind. How human mind operates. If I do not educate my human mind to handle these issues concerning human condition, how can I discuss with others? How can I develop the concept of the other? By saying to myself, me too, I am the other for him. If I don't recognize him as the other, he will never look at me as the other to be respected, to be considered. If me, I have never been educated to look at you, to treat you, to talk with you as the other with whom I have to share. The philosophical exercise is about this. And the philosophical exercise is totally different from the theological exercise. Be careful. Theological exercise is very dangerous. And even in medieval ages, Muslim theologians and Muslim philosophers have been struggling, because they didn't have the same position of reason. They were using different reasons. The reason in philosophy is different from reason in theology. If we do not understand this, we shall never give any criteria to our children and ourselves to guide our own life. We don't have criteria. I just say to the other, me, I am a Muslim, you have to respect me as a Muslim, and let me behave as a Muslim. You, I don't recognize you. I don't know anything about your religion. Christianity, it's nothing. Doesn't count. And even I would think it's a wrong religion. You have to convert. Yes, people are thinking like this. I'm not inventing, you know it. If I don't listen to a Christian, to a Jew, to a Buddhist, Hindus and Muslims in India, how are they developing any dialogue? There is no dialogue there, even not a dialogue. Living together since centuries in India. And what's the issue of this? We create Pakistan. We create Bangladesh. These are the things. And the criteria will be taught at the schools, at the institutes, if we have institutes. It's not normal that the Ismaili community started to think about an institute like the one we are trying to build up only, how many years? Since 77? 77. It's not acceptable. Do you imagine this? Ismaili community who has to defend its identity. You have an identity. But how to defend it? By telling traditions? Oral traditions? Never learning it? Knowing what's about? What it speaks? And you cannot know about it if you do not go to school. And in the school, it depends which... who are the teachers you are going to put in the school? We are thinking also about the education. It's an enormous problem, which is not solved in the Ismaili community. The teaching you give in about Islam, there are a lot of things to think about. Otherwise, you are giving wrong criteria. Yes?
Graduate or educationalist or a scholar like you, but heard a lot of interesting material from you. You just mentioned that it is not just sufficient to be educated and to have a debate with the outsider to describe your identity. Now, my simple question is that, would you like to elaborate that in doing so, it is very essential that you should be practicing to what you are preaching?
I don't understand the last.
You see, you mentioned,
yes,
that we Ismailis,
yes,
are in a very good position.
Yes.
That we have a guide.
Yes.
That we know, we accept,
yes,
and we are greatly honored by your confirmation. Now, to create a debate, to convince the others that Islamic culture, what we believe in, is superior, is it just enough to say, or would the other listener would say, what are you practicing now?
Yes. Should we... try to convince other people that Islam is superior, then the debate cannot be engaged on that basis. Because modernity, the intellectual principle in modernity is first to know the history of religions which each one of us is proclaiming from himself as the religion of truth, the only one religion of truth. This we did through centuries. And modernity is against this posture. Of course, it recognizes the freedom of belief. You can believe that Islam is superior for yourself. But when you come to the public space, where you have other people who may say to you, Hinduism is the superior religion, also. Buddhism is the superior religion. Then what to do? If each one is proclaiming that it is superior, okay, we can listen to each one developing his arguments to convince the other that his religion is superior. Then we are going to engage a debate on history. A debate, excuse me to mention disciplines, scientific disciplines, on anthropology. A debate on linguistics to interpret the holy texts, which each one will claim to be the only one text to handle. So then we come to study. This will be the result. If we refuse to study in that way, then we come to violence, to war, inevitably, like we did so many times through history. So I think this position precisely is the one on which we have to be very careful when we want to engage a debate with Westerners. Because Westerners today would never say this. Even Christians, you know, the Concilium of 1965-67. What the Catholic Church did in this Concilium. Did you hear about this Concilium? You didn't. You see, you have no right to ignore it. Yes, you have no right. You are a citizen of a modern country where people are in their majority Christians, at least by culture. Even if they don't have the belief, they are still Christians by culture. You have to respect this culture, to know something about this culture, and to know what Catholic Church did in this country. It was a theological revolution. They made it peacefully. This revolution consists in saying, through the Catholic hierarchy, from the Pope to all the priests, that we will never say again, out of the church there is no salvation, because this is wrong. We shall never say to anyone in the world that our religion is superior to your religion. Isn't it a revolution? And now you will never hear from a Christian, when he speaks to you as a Muslim, that his religion is superior to your religion. Never.
I may have made a mistake in saying that we are but in explaining our definition of understanding Islam, if we are confronted with a question by the question,
yes,
your practice,
yes,
is against your practice, it is against your preaching, what you are practicing is against what you are telling intellectually.
Yes, I
meant.
Yes, yes.
Probably I'm sorry that I said that we are superior.
Okay, but it's good that you said it,
yes,
because you gave me the opportunity to mention